The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Here we are, broadcasting live, our last program of the week before we head into yet another Sabbath weekend. Today, of course, is December 7th, 2018, and I didn't really get any additional material on top of what we discussed yesterday to draw more attention to that small beginning from back in 1989. Perhaps I should have saved yesterday's study for today. In any event, as many of you well know, it was on this day 29 years ago that my father and John Amos were fired from the Worldwide Church of God. They were brought out to Pasadena, and they sat in there with Joseph Tkacza Jr. and Mike Fazell. And by the end of the meeting, which went on for 4 hours, they were then fired. And that's the beginning. That was the beginning of the Philadelphia Church of God. Two fired ministers, something like $80 on hand in the church fund, and then 12 people total. A small beginning, if ever there was one, just like the grain of mustard seed. And then you look at what it is today. Still, I mean, for the most part, we are scattered all over the earth, some 5,000 strong. But when you consider the work, when you consider the message going out, when you consider the publications being produced, two new ones here coming into the MPC just in the last couple of weeks, the booklets, the periodicals, all of the letters, all of the activities, all of the youth programs, all of the festivals, it really is amazing to be a part of it even here at Edstone, an extension of God's headquarters campus in Edmond, Oklahoma. It's a great and wonderful privilege, a real blessing every day, whether at God's campus in Edmond or here in the UK or anywhere where God's people are situated. There are blessings to go around. We truly are the most blessed people on this earth, those of us whose hearts are in God's work, those who are filled with the Spirit of God, overflowing with joy, joyful abundance. It really is the good life. Jesus said that he came to bring us the abundant life. That's in John 10 and verse 10. And you find that in the church, of course, there's trials and there's tests. There is some pressure. There is stress at times, fulfilling God's will, doing the work of God. But you see these examples from beginning to end in the Bible. Faithful servants of God who continued on searching for that holy, that eternal city. So many of them discussed there in Hebrews 11. They pressed forward. They anticipated the return of Jesus Christ. And now, of course, they're waiting a better resurrection, as Paul said in that same chapter, Hebrews 11. So what a joy and what a privilege it is to be able to serve God. And you see the excitement and the enthusiasm in the responses that we get from so many of our readers and our listeners and our viewers as they write in and talk about how much the work of God and the truth of God has changed their lives for the better. It's good to look back on these small beginnings. It's great to be reminded on anniversaries such as this, to be reminded of our own history, to understand better what God has done from the very beginning. There were all those in the Worldwide Church of God. Back then, of course, this massive, massive church, with this incredible reach, all of this power, these resources. You can read about this history in Raising the Ruins. Hundreds of millions of dollars coming in, all of these TV programs or stations carrying the program, Ambassador College, millions and millions, tens of millions of pieces of literature going out every year, even there in the late 80s. Even in those few years after Mr. Armstrong's death. And then we come along in 1989 and the early 1990s with next to nothing and just a few people. And so many of those top officials in the Worldwide Church of God, they laughed and ridiculed and mocked us. One of them saying that we're just a peanut shell in an ocean floating somewhere and it's not going to amount to anything. In fact, that's what happened to the big organization. That's what happened to the mother organization. They turned into a peanut shell. It took some years for it to happen. In fact, really, when you look back on it, it's stunning how fast that abomination of desolation set in. And where is that church today? Where is that organization today? Whatever happened to the Plain Truth? Or the World Tomorrow program, or Ambassador College, or the SEP programs, the summer educational programs for children, for teenagers. What happened? Where did they go? Why did they disappear? Well, in their place today, you have AC, as in Herbert W. Armstrong College. You have PYC, the Philadelphia Youth Camp. You have the Trumpet Magazine. You have the Key of David TV program. You have it all. You have, as I said yesterday, the G450. You have the UK campus. You have the Jerusalem Dig. You have the Work in Jerusalem. And on and on and on it goes. God has raised the ruins. That's in Amos 9, verses 11 and 12. It's just like it was in the days of old. With one exception, it's being done. God's doing it through just a tiny fraction of people compared to 1985. We don't have 100 or 120,000 people attending our Feast of Tabernacles observances. Today, it's just about 5,000. And yet the work, if our minds are on the work, what an inspiration, what a lesson. What a lesson there is in the mustard seed parable. What a lesson there is in Zechariah 4. Small beginnings. Don't despise the day of small beginnings. And you won't, as I said at the end of yesterday's show, you won't if you're measuring yourself. If you're being measured God's way, if you're using this truth, this instruction, this teaching, and applying it to your own life, if you're measuring your life day in and day out, then you're going to know. You're going to recognize God's voice. You're going to recognize the truth of God. You'll know where the work is. You'll know where the work is situated, where it's headquartered. You'll know who the true ministers of Jesus Christ are. Happy anniversary to those of you that have been supporting God's work these past 29 years, if you're one of the few that were there from the beginning, or for the past 10, 15 years, or maybe for the past 10 or 15 months, whatever it might be, December 7th, 1989, a day that will live on in our memories, a glorious start. A small one, but a glorious beginning to the Philadelphia Church of God. Well, we've got a few things to get to on today's program. Another Bible study coming up later on, where we'll go through some powerful verses in 2 Corinthians 10 and build a study around a couple verses in particular there. But before we get to that, some more on the deep state here in just a moment. And then also, these are some critical days here in the UK as the British Prime Minister, Theresa May, her position just continues to weaken. Lots of uncertainty in the next few days. This catastrophic Brexit deal, it's looking now like it's dead on arrival. Just about everyone now expects it to fail in Parliament next week. And so the big question is, what's next for Britain? And a follow-up question might well be, who's the next prime minister? The Telegraph had this to say. Cabinet ministers told Theresa May on Thursday that she might come up with an 11th-hour plan to get her Brexit vote through the Commons. As the chief whip admitted, she will lose Tuesday's vote. It says the prime minister was confronted in Downing Street by Amber Rudd and other senior ministers who demanded to know what she intends to do to salvage the vote. How's she going to get out of this? It could fail slightly, or it could be overwhelming. We'll wait and see next week. That's still up for speculation, though. I think most of them are in agreement. Most of the commentators are in agreement that it's not going to pass. It says the prime minister is expected to suffer the largest defeat in political history. Well, here's the Spectator weighing in, I guess, with something more emphatic. It says, ideally, we lose this by a safe margin between 40 and 200 votes, one cabinet member tells me. If it's less than 40, his logic runs, Brussels would expect her to call the vote again. If she loses by 200 votes, the party itself might be ruined. But if it's 100 votes, even the Maybot could not pretend, as she likes to say, that nothing has changed. She would resign or be prevailed upon to do so. Her party would then have a very short period of time to decide what happens next. So that's happening right now in Britain. You have Boris Johnson, who certainly has his eye on that prime ministership, and he's been out talking about Winston Churchill, saying that what would Churchill do? He had to go up against European leaders. He had to stand firm. And so he's bringing up Churchill. And in the meantime, you've also got these dramatic changes happening in Germany with respect to Germany's leadership. Conservatives in Germany, the Christian Democratic Union, they're meeting today to choose a new leader. And so this decision will likely come down in the next day or two. We'll find out anyway. And we know all about Angela Merkel stepping down. And we know all about the Daniel 8-man prophecy. We also understand that Britain, however this happens, however it unfolds, and we don't know all the details, but we know that Britain is going to be on the outside of that European combine. And just in going through the prophecies regarding that seventh and final resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire, and I've brought this out before on the program, but so much detail and specificity when you go through chapters like Revelation 17, and God's just laying it all out there for us. And by the way, that was written 2,000 years ago. And then you look at the history. You look at the previous six resurrections of the so-called Holy Roman Empire. And then now we wait for the seventh and final one before the return of Jesus Christ to this earth. We're living in the last days. And there's proof of it in our headlines every single day. How could Mr. Armstrong know as early as the 1950s that Britain would be no part of it? How could he know with the establishment of that union in 1972 or 3 that it wouldn't work out for Britain? These are some dramatic prophecies being fulfilled, happening right here in Europe. It doesn't get nearly enough attention in the United States, not with what goes on there every single day. The attacks, the coup, the political coup against Donald Trump. Here, this investigation's been going on for 19 months. 19 months now, and we still don't know when it will end. Some commentators are saying it's going to happen soon, but how do you know? Who's to say? CNN had an interesting revelation yesterday. This was a piece, I guess, that was posted last night, and then it was on all the CNN programs last evening. This frantic scramble before Mueller got the job. It says here at CNN, this is from last night, in the hectic 8 days After President Donald Trump fired FBI Director James Comey, Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, and top FBI officials viewed Trump as a leader who needed to be reined in. Can you imagine reading something about Barack Obama, something like this, from any source, a couple years into Obama's presidency? Well, I mean, he needed to be reined in. So we had to trigger this investigation. We had to spy on him. We had to do all of these things. We had to go to a FISA court, even with an unverified dossier. He had to be reined in. He was exercising too much power. That would have never happened. But in this presidency, it not only happened, it continues. It continues. It's never ending. Here's how the breaking news, as they called it last night, here's how it was reported on Anderson Cooper's show. This is clip one.
We have learned that in the hectic 8 days after President Trump fired FBI Director James Comey, Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein and top FBI officials viewed Trump as a leader who needed to be reined in, and they discussed a range of options. Ultimately, then-acting FBI Director Andrew McCabe took the extraordinary step of opening an obstruction of justice investigation on the sitting president, Donald Trump, even before Special Counsel Robert Mueller was appointed.
So even before the appointment of Robert Mueller, you had McCabe, the confirmed liar, and he's no longer working with the FBI, but you had him taking, as CNN admits, this extraordinary step of opening up an obstruction of justice investigation. This reporter, I forget her name, but she went on to say this, clip two.
It was an idea that we're told the FBI had previously considered, but the probe wasn't opened officially until after Comey was fired and before Mueller was appointed. Now, the justification went beyond Trump's firing of Comey, according to the sources, and also included the president's conversation with Comey in the Oval Office, asking him to drop the investigation into his former National Security Advisor, Michael Flynn.
So she's talking about these other investigations that could be going on, and then she's providing there the justification for the Mueller probe, which was a conversation that the president had with James Comey. I think it was in February of 2017. And then the fact that he fired James Comey before Mueller came along. As you know, there was this counterintelligence investigation going on into Russian meddling. And Comey had told President Trump back in January, the year or the month of his inauguration, January 2017, you're not part of this. And so this investigation continues, but then the firing of Comey happens. And right after he's fired, remember, he leaked all of that information to the New York Times. His friend, all in these conversations, notes from these conversations that he had with the president. Now, all of a sudden, they're splashed across the front pages of the New York Times. President Trump suggested that we go easy on Mike Flynn. He's obstructing justice. And Mike Flynn, in case you didn't notice this week, 19 months on, here comes Bob Mueller suggesting to the court, look, go. We're not recommending any kind of prison sentence. He made some misstatements. That's what it amounts to. He made misstatements. And then he was pressured. They put pressure on him just as they've put pressure on other witnesses. And so he pleaded guilty. His career ruined because of this never-ending investigation. It says in this CNN revelation from last night, the new details about the genesis of the obstruction case into Trump that became a key element of the Mueller probe shed light on the chaotic week following Comey's firing and the scramble to decide how best to respond. They also helped to explain the origins of the Mueller investigation that has stretched across 19 months, consumed Trump's presidency, well, they get that right, and is building toward a dramatic day of courtroom filings on Friday or today. So there's some filings today. But notice it says there that it sheds light on this chaotic week following Comey's firing. And I submit to you that there was nothing chaotic about it. In fact, it was calculated. In fact, it was a conspiracy from the beginning. And that we now know because of the dossier, because of the FISA applications, because of the spying on Carter Page and others, because of the informants, and because of what led up to Comey's firing. In fact, the firing itself, how soon we forget, the memo, Rod Rosenstein submitting that memo on May 9th, and what that memo was full of, all of these current and former employees of the Justice Department, the FBI, all of them saying that Jim Comey needed to be fired. And you listen to Democrats today, and you would think that they've loved Jim Comey from day one. In fact, they despised him. They wanted him fired before Barack Obama left office. Let me read to you what this Rosenstein memo says. This is from May 9th, 2017, and it would have been the same day that Comey was fired. And so Rosenstein, writing to the Attorney General, Jeff Sessions at that time, and of course, by extension, he's writing to the President as well. It says here, over the past year, the FBI's reputation and credibility have suffered substantial damage, and it has affected the entire Department of Justice. That is deeply troubling to many department employees and veterans, legislators, and citizens. I cannot defend the director's handling. That's talking about Jim Comey, Rod Rosenstein, saying, I cannot defend his handling of the conclusion of the investigation of Secretary Clinton's emails. You'll remember he had the big press conference in July of 2016, and he came out and said, we've got all of this damning evidence, but we're not going to pursue this. The investigation stops here. And Rosenstein in this memo says to the president, he says to the Trump administration that his judgment, Comey's, was mistaken. Almost everyone agrees that the director made serious mistakes. It is one of the few issues that unites people of diverse perspectives. It's one of the few things that we all can agree on, that he really botched this up. It says the director was wrong to usurp the Attorney General's authority on July 5th, 2016, and announce his conclusion that the case should be closed without prosecution. It is not the function of the director to make such an announcement. On July 5th, however, the director announced his own conclusions about the nation's most sensitive criminal investigation without the authorization of duly appointed Justice Department leaders. He just went ahead and did it. He did it on his own. He did it without consulting with the DOJ. Rosenstein says, compounding the error, the director ignored another longstanding principle. We do not hold press conferences to release derogatory information about the subject of a declined criminal investigation. If you're not going to go forward with the investigation, then why do you have to make a big public display and tell the whole world everything that you found? It says the director laid out his version of the facts for the news media as if it were a closing argument, but without a trial. Everything about this was wrong. Everything about this was flawed. In other words, that's what he's saying. And then he talks later, too, about Comey's reasoning for reopening the investigation. You remember when they found all of those additional emails on Anthony Weiner's computer. It says further on, my perspective on these issues is shared by former attorneys general and deputy attorneys general from different eras and both political parties. And then he gives quotes from all of these attorney generals from years past. And both sides, Democrat, Republican. Judge Lawrence Silberman, who served as deputy attorneys general under President President Ford wrote that it is not the Bureau's responsibility to opine on whether a matter should be prosecuted. Silberman believes that the director's performance was so inappropriate for an FBI director that he doubts the Bureau will ever completely recover irreparable harm and damage thanks to Jim Comey. He doubts what this individual who worked at the FBI as an attorney general, he doubts whether the FBI reputation will ever fully recover following the actions of Jim Comey. He quotes from another one who served under President George W. Bush. We've heard a lot about the Bush family this week. Alberto Gonzalez, who also served as attorneys general under President George W. Bush, called the decision an error in judgment. Eric Holder, listen to this. Eric Holder, we know about him, don't we? He served as a deputy attorneys general under President Clinton and attorneys general under President Obama. He said that the director's decision, Comey that is, was incorrect. It violated long-standing Justice Department policies and traditions. Holder concluded that the director broke with these fundamental principles and, quote, negatively affected public trust in both the Justice Department and the FBI. There's more. Another one who served under President H.W. Bush. And then here's his conclusion. Rod Rosenstein on Jim Comey. This is the Rod Rosenstein memo. This is what led to Comey's firing. Rosenstein says here at the close, we should reject the departure and return to the traditions. We should reject, that is, reject this departure that Comey has us on at the FBI and return to the traditions, to the norms. Although the president has the power to remove an FBI director, the decision should not be taken lightly. I agree with the nearly unanimous opinions of former department officials, Rosenstein says. The way the director handled the conclusion of the email investigation was wrong. As a result, the FBI is unlikely to regain public and congressional trust until it has a director who understands the gravity of the mistakes and pledges never to repeat them. We need a new FBI director, in other words. We're not going to begin the healing process until we get a new one. Rosenstein says, having refused to admit his errors, the director cannot be expected to implement the necessary corrective actions. Comey's made all these mistakes, and he simply refuses to admit his errors. He's too arrogant. He won't admit his mistakes. He won't say that he did anything wrong. So he has to go. That's the gist of this memo, backed with all of these statements from attorney generals from years gone by. And what did he say at the start of the memo? Well, the not just the veterans of the force, but legislators, citizens. We've lost our reputation. We've damaged it. Now, going back to this CNN report from last night, where they talked about supposedly this chaotic week from when Comey was fired and Mueller was appointed back in July of 2017. Listen to this exchange on Anderson Cooper's show last night. Well, first you'll hear Anderson Cooper make a statement, and then that's followed by Congressman Eric Swalwell, who is responding to what Cooper has to say. Clip three.
I mean, the irony is, and I guess it's not the first time that we've realized this, that had the president not fired Comey, he might have spared himself the special counsel portion of this whole saga, if not this initial FBI investigation we're learning about.
That's right. And, you know, again, that the president's worst instincts continue, I think, to haunt him.
The president's worst instincts? They're haunting him? They continue to haunt him? It was his worst instinct that caused him to fire Jim Comey on May 9th, 2017? It was this memo. It was this memo. I'm not saying he didn't want to fire Comey. I think he said after the fact that he should have probably done it earlier. But are these his worst instincts? What about all of these former attorney generals? What about what Rosenstein said? Or you go right down the list. Judge Lawrence Silberman. Former Attorney General Michael Mukasey. He served under George W. Bush. Alberto Gonzalez, I quoted him. Eric Holder from the Obama administration. Donald Ayer, who served under President H.W. Bush. He was astonished and perplexed by the decision to break with long-standing practices followed by officials of both parties during past elections. All of these former officials, top officials, to say nothing of every single Democrat in August and September of 2016 who were calling for Comey's head because they said he ruined Hillary Clinton's chances. So the president follows through on May 9th, 2017. He fires Comey, and then we hear this. This is a CNN revelation, and they're saying, well, if he wouldn't have fired him, he probably wouldn't have this special counsel after him. What's revealing about that clip that I just played for you is that they're acknowledging, they're revealing themselves here. They're acknowledging that there would have been no special counsel were it not for the firing. But why did he get fired? What was it? What was the straw that broke the camel's back? That would be the memo from Rod Rosenstein. Then you follow Comey's tracks. Following his firing, he's holding on to these memos that he wrote following private conversations with President Trump, memos that he had to keep private until after he was fired. Then, as Comey has testified, then he's a private citizen. And now he can make this known. Now he can become the leaker-in-chief. Now he can send all of these memos to the New York Times. And now the New York Times and the whole world sees that President Trump was telling Comey privately, look, you've got to go easy on Mike Flynn. He's a good man. He hasn't done anything wrong. Wait a minute, you're obstructing justice. And then, added to that, you fired Jim Comey. You see the strategy through and through. You see how they've revealed themselves. It's exactly what some sharp commentators were saying from the start. This is all an orchestrated coup. That's what this is. It's a coup attempt by his political enemies to reverse the results of the 2016 election. That's what it amounts to, the CNN revelation from last night. It says, prior to Comey's firing, top FBI officials had discussed opening an obstruction investigation based on the president saying to Comey, I hope you can let this go when discussing Flynn. That episode was later described in memos Comey wrote following the February meeting that the former FBI director would leak soon after his firing. The deep state wanted Comey to be fired. They needed Comey to be fired. And in fact, it would help them immensely right now if President Trump would fire Rosenstein. And so here you have this big revelation in CNN last night saying that, well, Rosenstein, he's in a difficult position. This piece says here, for the deputy attorney general, the obstruction investigation into Trump and the appointment of the special counsel has turned his entire Justice Department tenure into an awkward role of supervising the Mueller investigation after he, voluntarily, sources said, wrote the memo justifying Comey's firing. Critics have argued the Comey memo makes Rosenstein a potential witness in the obstruction case. Of course he's conflicted, but he's still there. He's still calling the shots. He's giving Mueller free rein to do whatever he wants. And that's why this investigation is all over the map. And nothing about it, or nothing included in it, There's no evidence of Russian collusion. In fact, you know what's most fascinating about this article, this revelation from CNN last night? You read through the piece from beginning to end, and not one time will you see the word Russia or collusion. Not one time. There's nothing. There's nothing there on that, and I think it's interesting too. Just what's transpired this week. What Bob Mueller said about Mike Flynn in his sentencing memo from Monday, where he recommended no jail time for Mike Flynn. He says here, this is what he recommended to the court. Bob Mueller said the defendant's military and public service are exemplary. He served in the military for over 33 years, including, think for a moment as I read this, think about what President Trump supposedly, and we're only going on Comey's word, but think about what he supposedly told Comey in February of 2017. Hey, you need to go easy on Mike Flynn, or worse to that effect. He's a good man. This is unnecessary, this attack on Mike Flynn. Well, here's Bob Mueller telling the court a year and a half later. Sorry, 2 years, 2.5 years later. Well, whatever it is, it's hard to keep track. It says here, the defendant's military and public service are exemplary. He served in the military for over 33 years, including 5 years of combat duty, led the Defense Intelligence Agency, and retired as a 3-star lieutenant general. The defendant's record of military and public service distinguished him from every other person who has been charged as part of the SCO's investigation. He's had an impeccable track record. His career speaks for itself. He said essentially on Monday, he said what President Trump said in February of 2017. And here they went after this man for a misstatement, for a trap, a perjury trap, and probably a threat to go with it. A threat aimed at his son, destroying the man's career. And they get to the end, and at least Bob Mueller says this, but it's too little, too late. He goes on and says here, however, senior government leaders should be held to the highest standards. Oh, really? Senior government leaders? Would that include Jim Comey? Andy McCabe? Would that include Loretta Lynch? Eric Holder? Barack Obama? Would that include Peter Strzok? Lisa Page? Senior government leaders should be held to the highest standards. The defendant's extensive government service should have made him particularly aware of the harm caused by providing false information to the government. Well, he is a great man. He doesn't deserve to go to prison, but he is a senior official. And senior officials, they should be held to the highest standards. They should be, says Bob Mueller. What an expose. Exposing themselves. The truth is, they needed Comey to get fired in order for this special counsel to be appointed. And oh, by the way, Jim Comey, just as the president tweeted out this morning, Jim Comey and Bob Mueller, they're the best of friends. Oh yes, it's all connected. Comey, Rosenstein, Bob Mueller, Andy McCabe, Peter Strzok, Lisa Page. Some of it's been cleaned out. None of them, though. None of them prosecuted. None of them held to the highest standards of justice. With Mike Flynn, that's an altogether different story. And it certainly is a different story when it comes to President Trump. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. The developed nations have made awesome progress. They have produced a highly mechanized world, providing every luxury, modern convenience, and means of pleasure. Yet they are cursed with crime, violence, injustice, sickness and disease, broken homes and families. At the same time, more than one half the world is living in illiteracy, abject poverty, filth and squalor. Violence and destruction are rapidly multiplying. Many ask, why, if God exists, does he allow so much violence and human suffering? To understand the reason behind this astonishing paradox, request a complimentary copy of Mystery of the Ages. We were born into this 20th century world as it is. We take it for granted, but we can't explain it. It's like viewing a movie at a point already near the end. We see what is occurring at that point, but not having seen it from the beginning and not knowing how events developed to the point of viewing, we simply cannot understand what we are seeing. Mystery of the Ages transports you back to the beginning of the movie, to the foundation of this present evil world. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Fleury.
In 2 Corinthians 10, the Apostle Paul brings God's soldiers on, well, he informs us, he briefs us, rather, on the spiritual weaponry that we need in this do-or-die fight that we're engaged in spiritually. And he reveals where this spiritual battlefield is located. It's in our minds. It's in our thoughts. And we've got to fight. And we've got to go on the offensive, as my father brings out in How to Be an Overcomer. He says, the offensive is three or four times as hard as passively enduring from day to day. It therefore requires all possible help in the early stages. Nothing is easier than to smother it in the cradle. That's my father, I think, quoting from Winston Churchill. It's all too easy to smother it in the cradle, to think, well, I'll just hang back. I'll be casual. I'll be passive. I'll just settle into a defensive posture. When it comes to our battle against sin, you have to go on the offensive. It says in the book, if going on the offensive is three or four times harder, you need to be wholehearted, or you're going to get out on the battlefield and begin to hesitate. And you're going to get slaughtered, he says, physically and spiritually. We can't hesitate out on the battlefield. And it's a battlefield. It's a hard fight that we're in. Paul said we need to endure hardness in 2 Timothy 2. But here in chapter 10 of 2 Corinthians, it says in verse 4, for the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty through God, and to the pulling down of strongholds. The weapons of our warfare, they're not physical, they're spiritual, and they're mighty through God. So much so that you can pull down strongholds, it says. We have some mighty weapons at our disposal. We have all of this armor, Ephesians 6, it's listed out there, but we can wear this spiritual armor and actually go out each day and be ready for battle and pull down these strongholds with the help and the power of God. You can look at that word strongholds in the Greek and see that it means vain imaginations, human reasonings, self-righteousness, Paul continues in verse 5 saying, casting down imaginations, those vain imaginations, and every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God, and bringing into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ. Casting down every high thing that exalts itself. That's what Lucifer did. Isaiah 14, Ezekiel 28. He wanted to put his position of authority even above God's. He said, I will exalt my throne. That's a high thing. Paul cautioned us in Romans 12:3 not to think of ourselves more highly than we ought to think. Beware high things, exalted thoughts, or thoughts of self-exaltation. Casting down imaginations and every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God, and bringing into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ. And so we see here, we see where the battle is, or where the battlefield is in this war. Our warfare, primarily, it takes place within our minds. That's where we're facing just major battles every day. There may be some small ones too, some small skirmishes, you could say. But every day, we have to go on the offensive. We have to plug into God's mind. We have to let the mind of Christ in, as Philippians 2:5 says. And that only happens after regular, earnest, fervent prayer and deep, diligent, Berean-like Bible study every day. With that, we'll recognize the enemy, and we'll have the power to overcome and to conquer. We'll have a battle plan if we're using God's word to measure, as I said yesterday. And we surely do need God's help and power, because the carnal mind is... Well, we can just look at this in Jeremiah 17, but it's so deceitful. There's a built-in hostility there with that carnal mind, hostile to God's law, hostile to God's truth. Over in Jeremiah 17, verse 5, it says, thus says the Eternal, cursed be the man that trusts in man and makes flesh his arm or his strength. Yesterday I read you that verse in Zechariah 4, where it says that Zerubbabel in this end time, he didn't rely on human might or power. He relied on God's power. Here it says that you're cursed if you rely upon human might or strength, physical strength. Cursed is the man who makes flesh his arm and whose heart departs from the Lord. We've got to put our faith not in men, not in the material or the physical, but in God. It says of those who make flesh their arm, verse 6, he's like a stunted shrub in the desert with no hope for the future. He lives on the salt-encrusted plains in the barren wilderness. Good times pass him by forever. That's the Living Bible, the paraphrase. It's like living on the shores of the Dead Sea, God says, putting your faith and your trust in men. There's no way that you can thrive in an environment like that. But if you're looking to God, if you're trusting in God's power and strength, Jeremiah says in verse 7, blessed is the man that trusts in the Eternal, and whose hope the Lord is. For he shall be as a tree planted by the waters, and that spreads out her roots by the river, and shall not see when heat comes, but her leaf shall be green, and shall not be careful in the year of drought, neither shall cease from yielding fruit. You'll be just like a beautiful fruit-producing tree. We're judged by fruits, aren't we? Jesus said that in Matthew 7. Bringing forth fruit, the kind of fruit listed off in Galatians 5, it brings glory to God. If we bring forth much fruit, that's John 15. And then verse 9 here, this is Jeremiah 17. This is the memory verse I mentioned a moment ago. It says, the heart is deceitful. It's deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it? Who can know this desperately wicked or this dangerously sick heart? The heart of man, the mind of man. And yet when you look at the world system of education, what they say about the human heart, what they say about man's progress, quote unquote, the educational system looks upon man as being basically good and trustworthy. There's a few aberrations here and there. There's a few exceptions to this rule, but for the most part, we're pretty good. We're proud of ourselves. We look at mankind today, even 6,000 years on from Adam, and we conclude, yeah, this world's a pretty good place. I think it's just getting better and better. That's not the way God sees human nature. And if you're a realist with your eyes open to what's happening in this world, then you're going to agree with God. Man hasn't been able to solve the problems of this world. And it's because of this deceitful mind. It's because of this terminal illness, this sickness, this hostility, as Romans 8:7 says. Well, continuing on, you can hold your place. If you're reading along with me, just put a marker in Jeremiah 17, and I'll read this section from Matthew 9. Verse 10, it says, and it came to pass, as Jesus sat at meat in the house, behold, many publicans and sinners came and sat down with him and his disciples. And when the Pharisees saw it, and they said to the disciples, why eat your master with publicans and sinners? But when Jesus heard it, he said to them, they that be whole need not a physician, but they that are sick. But go you and learn what that means. I will have mercy and not sacrifice, for I am not come to call the righteous, but the sinners to repentance. He's not saying here that the Pharisees were righteous by any means. What he was actually saying is that they failed to see their own sick minds. They didn't see that they needed a physician. This is the number one problem of humanity today. The fact that we can't see how much we need a physician. We can't see the sickness of the human heart. We're bringing ourselves right to the brink of total annihilation. And before we can ever accept Christ, whether in this age or in the age to come, we have to see that sickness. Of course, in the world tomorrow, Satan will be put away and all of his broadcasting to go with it. But still, everyone's going to need to be educated and taught about this evil nature that comes from the devil. We have to see the sickness before we can accept Christ. Back in Jeremiah 17, verse 10, it says, I, the Eternal, search the heart. I try the reins, even to give every man according to his ways and according to the fruit of his doings. God tries the reins. God guides our course. If we'll submit to him, and if we confess our sins and point out that we're sick in the mind, verse 14 says, heal me, O Lord, and I shall be healed. Save me, and I shall be saved, for you are my praise. Only God can heal the human heart. And that's what he intends to do for all of mankind. But for us today, those of us called out of this world, returning again to 2 Corinthians 10:5, just to conclude here, once again it says, casting down imaginations and every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God, and bringing into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ. Every single thought. We can't be satisfied with just a few victories. We have to work at it daily, bringing every thought into alignment with Jesus Christ. My father in the booklet, How to Be an Overcomer, he says this in the chapter, The Science of Spiritual Warfare. He writes, when you have to tackle a problem, Concentrate everything you have on that problem. Bring everything possible to bear on solving it. Do you lay siege to your big problems? A siege is a military blockade of a city or a fortified place intended to compel it to surrender. It is a persistent attack. To lay siege means to pursue diligently or persistently. How about preparing a siege against your laziness or your lust or sense of inferiority or vanity or whatever your problem you face? Lay siege on it. Go right at the heart of it with everything you can. Destroy its will. Decimate your old man's will to rise back up, and you will conquer it. That's the key to victory right there. There's the battle plan. There's the strategy. It's laid out there for us in 2 Corinthians chapter 10, verses 4 and 5. Well, that's all that we have time for. We come to the end of yet another week of broadcasting here on KPCG and KPCG.fm. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next week.